The battle against HIV and AIDS has changed a lot since the virus was first identified in 1983. With the implementation of PrEP, a daily pill that effectively blocks HIV transmission, we've seen a decrease in new HIV infections overall. But Black young people are still disproportionately the largest group for new HIV infections.
What can we do to make sure that the fight against HIV and AIDS is equitable? Today, writer Terrence Chappelle joins us to talk about his work creating awareness about access to HIV prevention.
Plus, Janelle Monáe opens up the Oscars saying she's proud to be here as a Black queer artist.
Billy Porter's wild red carpet fashion sparks a backlash.
And former Empire actor Jussie Smollett is back in the news, indicted again by a grand jury in Chicago. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion, and welcome to Feast of Fun. Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Unlock a delicious world of podcasting magic and listen to thousands of amazing shows at feastoffun.com/plus.
Hello, honeys. Today we're going to be talking about HIV and AIDS. Yay! Joining us today is writer Terrence Chappelle, who's been working to help draw awareness and help change the way young Black people access HIV prevention. How are you, Terrence?
I'm good. It's been so long since I've seen you guys.
I know.
It's been a while.
It's been
probably 10 years since you've come on the podcast, back when you were just a little baby gay.
I know.
And now
so much has changed. I was so untouched.
And now you're a seasoned veteran of the battle for equality.
I like that. Thank you.
Now, tell me about the time you thought you became HIV positive.
It was very scary. So I was 28 and I was hooked up, met this guy. We went on a few dates and then we hooked up, and then, you know, he stayed over the night, and the next morning he left. And then he sent me a text message maybe 10 minutes after he left saying that he was HIV positive, but he was undetectable at the time. But we didn't use condoms, and I was not on PrEP, and I didn't know I had very base knowledge of PrEP. And so of course I completely freaked out.
For people who don't know what PrEP is, it is a daily pill that you can take that effectively blocks HIV infections. And it's been kind of controversial in the sense that people are thinking, just like birth control pills, that women are going to fuck everything now because they don't get pregnant.
There's no consequences.
And with HIV, with PrEP, with these pills of Truvada and now Descovy, people are sounding the alarm, conservative people are, that gay men are going to be, having all the sex that they want.
Well, I think that will happen no matter what.
Yeah.
So, if people are going to be festive, independent uh-huh. of like what's out there. But I think for me that really was my introduction to PrEP, because I remember calling my friend and completely freaking out and saying, oh my God, I'm HIV positive, mm-hmm. and not really, having an idea of what PrEP is or that PEP was out there. And for people who don't know, PEP is, if you have been exposed to, potentially HIV, that you can take PEP and that would flush it out.
And did you go on PEP? What did you do?
So I was like, we need to go to Walgreens. I don't know why I said that to my friend. Like, we gotta go to urgent care. I was like freaking out. And so I called up, and that's how I got introduced to Harold Brown, mm-hmm. because at the time I was working for Walgreens, managing the social media, mm-hmm. Working as a consultant, and I didn't have insurance at the time. So mm-hmm. It was a very scary moment. I went on PEP and I was HIV negative.
And PEP is post-exposure.
Exactly, post-exposure.
So is it the same medication that you take pre-exposure prophylaxis or something different?
It's different. So for PrEP, it's very dangerous to be on PrEP and to not know that you're HIV positive, is because PrEP, while it is a HIV preventative medication, it's also an ingredient in the cocktail that doctors use to treat HIV positive people. Mm-hmm. So like if you are in PrEP and you are HIV positive,
you're suppressing that.
Exactly. It's very difficult to treat you.
Yeah.
So that's how I got on PrEP. And like I never looked back. It was a very scary moment. It was very much a teachable moment for me, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, you were like, oh, girl, it's time to party.
Now, I'm good now.
Did the person have a suppressed viral load? Were they untransmittable at the time?
Yes.
Or is that something you didn't really? Because I think for a lot of people, too, it's like it's hard for them to wrap their heads around the fact that you can take a pill that's 99.9% effective of you not getting HIV. But the fact that somebody already is HIV positive and that they are taking AIDS medication and they do become undetectable, that it's virtually impossible for them to pass on the virus. And it's a stumbling block for some people because it's just like, well, they're like, what's that 1% chance? It was like, well, or like tiny percent chances has a lot of fear. And I think a lot of that is because of the stigma around HIV and AIDS.
Well, and then there's the same reason people are terrified of flying in an airplane. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, you talk to Whoopi Goldberg about it. She, you know, she will not get on an airplane. She gets on a bus and goes between New York and L.A.
Oh, God.
And part of it is like, you know, some people just have a really hard time wrapping their heads around, you know, what it means to be 99% effective.
Yeah, people. And I think people are still dependent and kind of relied on these very archaic views of what it means to be HIV positive and what it means to have AIDS is because PrEP is fairly new when you think about it, in the context mm-hmm. of the battle and fight against HIV and AIDS. And so there's a lot of people who still don't know about PrEP mm-hmm. and there's a lot of people who know about it and aren't on it. So it's we could get rid of the virus in just one generation. But it's a challenge to disseminate this kind of communications, and information to communities, in particular Black men who have sex with men. Mm-hmm. It's very much a layered problem. There's a mistrust of medical doctors. Those in power aren't always placing the need or aligning resources, with communities who really need them.
Mm-hmm. And so when you had sex with this guy, he called you later. He's like,
he text messaged me.
He text
it was no phone call.
What was your reaction to it?
I completely freaked out. Like I remember what I was thinking. I said, I'm just another statistic now. I'm a Black man who's HIV positive. I felt lied to. I was scared. I was scared shitless. I don't know. I still can't. I was like, I just remember I was like, I need to go to Walgreens. I don't know why I thought of going to Walgreens. Like, I was like, I need to go to urgent care.
Well, that's healthcare for you in the United States, right? You know?
And then that's how I got introduced to Howard Brown, who I knew about. And that I saw a doctor at Howard Brown who was very kind, who was very nice. And that's how I got introduced to PrEP. And I actually ended up dating the guy. He ended up being like a complete...
Wait, you ended up dating your doctor?
No. I wish. I ended up dating the guy who text messaged me is because I didn't want to hold that against him, and I didn't want to. I like to think of myself as this very open person, mm-hmm. and I didn't want to stigmatize him. I don't know how it is to be HIV positive and be undetectable, and then mm-hmm. want to be with someone. And so, like, I wanted to kind of be empathetic, and we ended up dating. Obviously, it didn't work out for those reasons, but for other reasons.
Because he's a liar,
he's a lying whore. No, like, that's so bad.
He's a monster.
Well, and so you're. Why didn't it work out?
Well, he was nuts. He was, I think he was a very angry person. Mm. And I think he did not know how to properly express his anger. Mm. And it got violent. And the first time it got violent, I was like, I'm out. I'm done. All it takes is once. I'm good. Yeah, I was like, screw this. It's like, plus I didn't want to hurt him. But then he actually ended up dating an associate of mine. And I remember seeing them in passing, and we were at this years ago, we were going to sidetrack for New Year's or whatever. And then I saw they were like hugged up on each other. And I so badly wanted to say something to my friend afterwards. And I still feel kind of bad but I didn't. I also, maybe I'm too nice. I also believe, like, maybe he's having a different experience. Yeah. Come to find out, he didn't. He hit him also, and he stopped dating him. He stopped dating him also. So
it's a tricky situation.
Yeah. It's like you want to give someone a heads up, but you also want them to have their experience with that person.
Yeah.
And then he ended up telling me afterwards, and I just admitted to him, like, I'm so sorry that I didn't tell you. And he understood. He's like, mm-hmm. He was like, I understand why you didn't tell me, and I appreciate you wanting me to kind of make my decision on my own.
And it's part of those things. It is one of those kinds of things you can warn people, but sometimes they resent being warned, and then they're like, well, it'll be different with me. You're that type of person. I'm this type of person. And then a lot of times it's the same exact experience.
And it's not even in just like in dating circles, you know, and kind of friendships. But at the same time, I think, you know, when we're betrayed by somebody, it robs us the ability to trust somebody in the future. Mm. And at the same time, you know, we also want to create a space where people who have harmed other people can grow and heal and undo the damage they've done to others.
100%. And I think him and a lot of other people are examples of when you don't deal with your problems. Because when you don't deal with your problems, they'll deal with you. You won't. And speaking from experience, you will not like how your problems deal with you.
And so, in a sense, you know, at least this negative experience got you aware of a prep. And it got you, not because you're not listening to the podcast, because we were talking about the day it came out.
Mm-hmm. You guys were.
We read the news item and I said, this sounds like too good to be true. And we reported on it and we talk about all kinds of things on Feast of Fun. And man, over the years, like, people have been like, you are the first person to do this journalism and stuff. And I was just like, I was just reading a press release.
No, well, that's not true. We followed the IPREX study, and we were very aware of the study, and it was coming and whatnot, because we were involved with the AIDS Foundation in Chicago. And so we were, you know, very interested in looking, like, what's it going to be like? How are we going to prevent HIV and AIDS? You know, and our friend Jim Pickett, he was very much a proponent of antimicrobials, like some kind of, like, microbial thing you'd be able to stick up your butt and
like a foam,
kind of prevent HIV infections. And then they were just like, well, how about this pill that's already like making people untransmittable? And so
that's the history of that. Yeah. But in terms of us, like, we were doing public service podcasts in the local gay and lesbian community center, the LGBTQ community center.
It's amazing.
Here in Chicago. And unfortunately, it turned to be very much like a situation where people wanted to ask awkward or embarrassing questions that they didn't feel comfortable privately asking a doctor. But in front of a studio audience of over 300 people, they raise their hand. They're like, one guy was like, I got a legitimate question about fisting. And Mark and I were like, fisking?
What the hell is that?
And he kept pointing at his elbow.
Yeah, how far he got his fist.
Sir, we get it.
Yes. And he's like, I put it up there and then I took it out and then it smelled. And the doctor's like, well, have you tried washing it? And he's just like, well, I did wash it. He's like, well, just keep washing it until it doesn't smell anymore.
Keep washing your elbow until it doesn't stink. Like, next question.
Well, it's because, you know, a lot of those odors are attached to oils, right? And so, believe it or not, there's a lot of oil in your poop and down there. Even like with skunks, when they spray something at you, it's like it's a type of oil, and so you just have to get rid of that oil.
And I know some people whose nickname is Skunk. And then there was another guy who was we were interviewing some of the first people to be on PrEP, and there was one young African American gentleman who was telling his story, much like you, of how they came to choose this path and the controversy that they faced from their friends and family over wanting to take a pill that prevented HIV. And then in the audience, somebody stood up and was like, well, I hear you guys talking about HIV and AIDS and all that stuff and condoms, but I don't hear nobody talk about no pleasure up in here.
Well, the title was like bringing sexy back or something. It was like, how do, because, you know, that's the thing. It's like when you do these talks about or do research on gay men's sexuality, a lot of people, it's just like, oh, it's sex. It's kind of fun. But why are you really doing it? What are you looking for? For a lot of people, it often goes overlooked is it's that sense of intimacy. You want to be with somebody. You want to feel with somebody. And so that's and so because we've been pathologizing gay men's sexuality, it's like, you know they're pedophiles. They're going to spread disease. You're going to get AIDS and die. That kind of stuff. That it's like, let's talk about what is important to us, and that pleasure is important to us.
We don't have no pleasure up in here. So every day since then, Mark and I are always going to each other. I don't hear nobody talk about no pleasure up in here.
But you know what? Even with you mentioned that you guys talked about HIV. Yeah. You guys were talking about PrEP, you know, right when it came out. Even with that communication and the town halls, that information still isn't reaching the populations it needs to reach.
Let's look at the numbers here. So in the last 15 years, from 2000 to 2015, new HIV infections have decreased by 40? Is it 46%?
46, like the rate 46%. Of HIV infections among blacks decreased by 46%.
That's wonderful.
That's wonderful.
However,
fast forward to 2018, according to Illinois AIDS VU, African Americans, according to the 2000 census, only accounted for, I believe, like 13 or 15% of the population. Mm-hmm. However, in 2018, we accounted for 42% of new HIV diagnosis.
Mm. So effectively, it's three times as much compared to other groups of new HIV infections.
Overrepresented.
So the efforts, although they're successful in reducing new HIV infections, are not going far enough. They're not sustainable. Meaning that they're getting lucky, but it might not be so lucky in the future of reducing those numbers.
Well, I think it's not sustainable in the sense that we're not seeing a consistent decline in new HIV diagnosis among blacks and African Americans. And it's one of those things that it's not, I know we were talking about earlier before the podcast about, like, it's not like, well, we're going to find it in 2 weeks. We won't find that probably until like 5 years or 10 years for them to like conduct a study. Mm-hmm. But I know one thing, like, you do have some organizations within Chicago that have, I do a great job at kind of having communications around PrEP and the PrEP for Love campaign that the AIDS Foundation of Chicago came out with. But that campaign, and no shade against them, but like that campaign was only in the loop in downtown. It didn't make it to the south side or the west side, where populations are being afflicted with HIV diagnosis, and in particular young people in high school.
Well, if we want to reach young black people, why don't we just pay T.S. Madison to talk about it? I mean, I'm serious. I mean, she's, you know, for a lot of young black people, it's like, their social media networks is where they're sharing and finding information about stuff.
Well, you do have OTV, which is
Open Television.
Yeah, Open Television. So I think they go by OTV. I think they go by OTV.
The O stands for Open.
Open. And so they
does it? I'm asking.
No, it. Yeah. Well, I know they did an acronym from OTV, but from my understanding, it stands for Open Television.
Okay.
And so Amar, who founded it, has a show specifically about PrEP, and I forget who they teamed up with, but basically it's a show where these, it's a fictitious characters, but it's based on these real life experiences of black men taking the drug. And so I think, to your point, leveraging social media in the way to kind of like educate, different, you know, communities who really need to get this information as another communication vehicle. But like, it's a very layered problem, that requires layered solutions. The CDC found that, black men who have sex with men are more likely to have sex with other black men. And so that's a petri dish for HIV, new diagnosis to thrive in.
It's an insulated community in many ways. So cause you find something like, when you have U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable, and then you have PrEP, and if a number of people in the community are using it, it kind of can break that cycle of HIV. And so it can, even if half the population or a quarter of the population is on it, it can have profound effects on it. But if nobody's on it or very few people are on it, then it's just so easier for the virus to spread. And if you're kind of like you say, like in a petri dish or your own cauldron or whatever, your own community, which is often the case of here in Chicago because of the way people live and segregation and housing, you're going to have sex with the people who are around you. Mm-hmm. And if you're surrounded just by black people, those are the people you're going to have sex with.
So Terrence, in terms of your actions, you're working with some organizations to try to change the way we're speaking to young black people and the way young black people are thinking about access to medicine and PrEP. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know for like one of my clients, Lamont J. Robinson, who represents the 5th District. The 5th District is one of the largest districts in Chicago. It covers as far south as Brownsville, as far north as Gold Coast and River North. And what he's doing is that he passed a bill last year which makes access to, because you used to have parental consent to even access PrEP. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people aren't out to their families. And so he's making it easy. Mm-hmm. You no longer need parental consent to access PrEP, mm-hmm. even as an adolescent. Mm-hmm. And so that's one, you know, hurdle that I think will definitely help. He's also, he's also building an LGBT, center. We don't have a site picked out just yet. And I think that will also help, kind of scale some communications and then just partnering with people within the community of people who look like you, to kind of help disseminate that messaging and be a partner, in the fight against HIV and AIDS.
Well, that's wonderful. So
that's great. Yeah, because I know especially early on, it's like there's a lot of college students and whatnot asking, like, oh, I should get on PrEP, or, you know, I'm still on my parents' insurance. Would they find out if I was taking PrEP, that kind of thing? And there are a lot of programs, especially in Illinois, and if you're young and you don't have money, you can get help. And, you know, to find those resources, it's super important.
Yeah, why don't you just put it in a vending machine? I mean, seriously.
I just put it in water, fluoride.
Yeah, actually. No, but the problem, I think people might overdose on that kind of medication. I think that's
We've all had those days where, like, I better take two pills.
Well, you know, that doesn't work.
I think with a lot of people, they focus on the pills, and it's the visits to the doctors, it's the regular test screenings for sexually transmitted infections, HIV, having that conversation, getting someone into a medical system. And that's why we're fighting for Medicare for all, because if we could save, there was one study that just came out today, and it was like, I think it was some, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like $400 billion a year would be saved if we implemented a single payer Medicare for all plan in the United States.
There's an entire strata of our society who just lives, doesn't work or do anything. They just live off of our healthcare money, like that we're paying into it. And we're talking like they've got yachts, they've got mansions, they've got jet planes. They don't do anything. They just collect big fat checks from the medical industry.
And part of it is, I think, you know, I think some of those people who do well financially from healthcare, they're thinking that their way of life might be at stake. And, you know,
profits.
You look at other countries who do have Medicare for all, and those people are still making a lot of money, you know. So part of it is, I think this idea of pitting different sectors in our healthcare industry against each other is not a constructive way of looking about accessing healthcare. And I think definitely, you know, we need to be pushing in this election for the candidates that are really working hard to gain universal access to healthcare, because our lives are at stake. Yeah. And not just our physical health, but also our financial lives.
And I think that, you hear a lot of social chatter.
And that's not Pete Buttigieg, just to be clear on that one.
To your point, you do hear a lot of social chatter is because you have these governmental figures and structures and whatever who aren't really doing anything. People are looking for companies and CEOs to be more purposeful in their mission and not just be concerned with making a profit, and to like kind of having more of like a social conscious angle to their mission and like kind of how they navigate through things.
But I think it, you know, to some degree, like seeing the negative, like I know some listeners who are, love the show, love the idea of a gay candidate for president of the United States who appeals to both progressives and conservatives. And because the bar has been set so low by Donald Trump that we're thirsty to some degree over being rescued by this oppressive tyrant.
His in polling, he's at 49%.
Who are you talking about? Trump.
Trump, he's at 49%. And that's not a huge surprise because the economy is doing so well. So typically when the economy is doing well, the rating of the president is very high. But there's no reason for him to change. There's no reason for him to kind of reframe his narrative, is because it's working for him.
But in a sense, like, you know, the way our healthcare system is right now, a lot of corporations, you know, benefit from people not having their healthcare be independent from their job. And so a lot of people stay with low paying jobs because they have access to affordable healthcare through their employer. And so those employers are going to have to start paying their employees more money if you can separate that in the future. So every multinational billion-dollar a year company is fighting against Medicare for all, in either directly or indirectly, because they understand that it's going to cost their bottom line in having to pay their employees more money in order to keep them, because they don't have to stay at the job if they can move around freely.
But will they save more money because they're not footing the bill for expensive insurance?
They will save more money, but in the end, you know, they're thinking about it in terms of how they can hold on to valuable employees without having to spend more money.
Try not being a jerk, and maybe they'll want to stick around.
Well, and part of that is they don't see it that way. They think they are treating their employees well by giving them health care. Mm-hmm. And so separating those two, I think, will actually go a long way in having a healthier employer and employee relationship and having a more financially stable population.
Right.
And then in terms of young African-American people, I don't know if necessarily the way we're talking about healthcare reform, I don't know if necessarily that access them.
Because traditionally they're people that have been left out of
They're always the ones that are left behind.
So even if we had Medicare for all, will there be, just like we talk about in the south side of Chicago, these food deserts? You know, there's going to be a healthcare desert.
And that's why I think it's so important that people, you know, vote in local elections and, and vote for your state rep and your congressman, is because I think it's very, to your point, there are some, like, independent of who is in office, some people will always fall through the cracks. And that's another reason why we are having these conversations about companies being more purposeful, is because I believe, like, what, like, nonprofit sector, like, collectively does, like, contributes like $492 billion. And that's still not enough. Like, that's still it. And it doesn't always get to the root of the problem. And I think the way one of the solutions is to, like, kind of not depend on the government, but, like, the government should scale what nonprofits are doing, is because they're their experts. You don't want to experiment with public money, because they're their experts. They're doing their work already, and maybe the government comes in like more of a support role to scale those efforts.
So, if people want to get involved and take action, what's a good way for them to get connected?
I would say for it, I mean, really getting connected, and it begins with you and having these conversations with your, having these conversations with your networks and having these conversations with your friends. I've had conversations with my friends who look like me or who don't look like me, and some of them are not on prep and some of them are on prep. And I think even beyond that, voting, definitely 100% voting, like knowing the candidates and kind of what they stand for, as well as, like, it sounds kind of trite, but volunteering for organizations who may not have the robust budget to have this mass marketing campaign.
And girl, I'm just trying to pay my bills and keep my head above water.
I mean, that's a lot of people.
You're asking me to go volunteer?
You can always do more.
You can, you know, at least, you know, phone bank.
And even beyond that, like, just knowing your status. Like, that's a way of contributing. Knowing your status, making sure you're...
Knowing what your partner's status is before you get into the...
Well, people...
Which I learned my lesson.
People are going to say...
You know.
All's fair in love and war. Yes. And people are going to say all kinds of things. It's a testament to your sex appeal, Terrence, is that people are going to lie to get a taste of you.
But also, too, I want to put it out there, though, too, is your odds are much better at having sex with somebody who's HIV positive and undetectable than with somebody who doesn't know their status. When they don't know their status, that's when you have
and
that
think
risk
about it. If you would have just told me, I wouldn't have cared. Like, if he just would have had that conversation with me, I would be like, oh, thank you for letting me know. We can still have sex.
You probably would have still sat on that dick.
You're making a lot of assumptions, Foster.
Be like, oh, shit. You know, but part of it is like, look, you know, you're very safe with somebody who is HIV positive and is on medication. because the new HIV infections usually come from people who don't know their status. So getting people to going see the doctor and getting on PrEP and getting tested is a great thing to do.
And I'm not sure if this figure is still out there, but it was a few years ago. 60% of new HIV infections come from people from their primary partner. So oftentimes it's you're with somebody, you're both you think you're both HIV negative, you're with each other for a few months, and then you're just like, oh, we don't need to use condoms anymore. And then you have sex, and then you discover that the other person is HIV positive because they didn't necessarily know it at the time either. And as long as we're talking about gay black men in Chicago, let's talk about Jussie Smollett for a moment.
Yay!
There's an update.
Because there is an update now. So as you guys might know, he claimed to have been attacked last January at like 2 o'clock in the morning. People supposedly were going to hang him and poured bleach on him. And it was also like minus 30 degrees outside in Chicago in Streeterville neighborhood. And, you know, everybody at first was just like, this just doesn't add up. It doesn't add up. And it seemed like more and more like his story wasn't adding up, and it became, you know, a big cause. People were talking about it. Eventually, no charges were pressed against him because they were saying that, people were saying he filed false charges. And then Kim Fox, who was our attorney general, she has some relationship with his family and dropped the charges, right? And so now the Cooks County office confirmed today that their special prosecutor, Dan Webb, has indicted Jussie Smollett in connection with the alleged attack. And so they said that a grand jury returned a 6-count indictment against Smollett, charging him with making 4 separate false reports to the Chicago police related to his false claims that he was a victim of a hate crime, knowing he was not the victim of a hate crime. And so he will be arraigned on February 24th.
I just don't know what that's going to solve. I mean, independent of whether he told the truth or didn't tell the truth, I just don't know what exactly that's going to solve.
Mm-hmm. Like, I think Dave Chappelle's responsible for bringing that back into the news with this whole
Juicy Smollett.
Yeah, when he said that in his stand-up special, I was like, I started questioning myself. I was like, is that really how he say his name?
Well, and Trump's also been kind of like pointing that out because, you know, they like to talk about Chicago corruption, and so they point to this as a form of Chicago corruption. Now, the charges were dropped against him late last year, in February, in exchange for community service and $10,000 bond payment. So it wasn't like he got off scot-free. Mm-hmm. He still had to, like, if he did indeed lie, which most people think he did lie.
Every single black person I work with, the day it happened, came up to me and they're like, what do you think about Jussie Smollett? And I was like, it seems very far-fetched.
Well, you know.
And they were like, he's totally guilty.
Well, you know.
Like, yeah, no, a lot of black people did not accept it.
The thing, speaking for myself, I would say that I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. And I do believe in, like, hearing, like, he has a right to tell his story. As the details unfolded, yes. It did not make any sense, especially in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But for me, that doesn't mean I want to throw him to a system that's going to tear him apart.
Exactly.
Like, I think he needs mental help.
So those are two separate things. Yeah. Is the system that systematically harms and oppresses black people unfairly, unjustly, and the fact that every single black person was like talking about this the day it happened, and they were all like not buying his story.
Well,
at
you
all.
Know. The thing about it and the nuance of it is that, like, I had white friends who automatically did not believe him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
And then I had it was kind of split. And I had some black friends who didn't necessarily believe him, but was willing to hear him out. Right. And I think that's where, for me, that's where the problem was. Is like, you just completely assumed that he's lying.
Right.
Your experience was that it was like a mixed reaction.
It was a very mixed reaction. And then I personally got offended by anyone who just didn't believe him. Mm-hmm. I'm like, he has a right to tell his story. Let's wait till the details come out. Came out, and as the details unfolded, I was like, okay.
We live in Chicago at 2 in the morning in that night.
It's Streeterville. Minus 20, 30 degrees out.
No one goes out to get a sandwich, especially if you're a paid celebrity. celebrity, mm-hmm. a major actor on a television mm-hmm. show, you're going to order room service.
And I'm thinking, you know, like, was it like a gay bashing that went wrong? Like, I'm thinking, like, well, how did he confuse these things or what happened?
Like, it was just a lot of things. Like,
because, you know, as a victim, you want to give mm-hmm. victims the benefit of the doubt. But then you're just like, wow, this isn't really adding up to anything. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are like, they're very mad. They want to see him punished. They're very angry. They want to see this happen. But it's also, like you said, what's that going to do? You're going to put him into a system that's unfair to people? I want to remind people, you know, they say like, oh, this costs the city of Chicago so much money. I want to remind people that since 2005, we have spent over $500 million. That's over $500 million paying people who have been victims of police brutality, and many of them, most of them, are African American. So this is the system that you're talking about that he's fucking over so much.
It happens so often that black people call it the lottery.
Yeah,
that that when you win the lottery, in quotations, is that you're getting a settlement from police brutality. And it's like, and you know, of course, it's meant mm-hmm. sarcastically yeah. because it usually is, mm-hmm. is involves the yes. death of yeah. a family member or loved one.
And so if you're one of those people that are just like, he's got what he's coming from him, and you're one of these people that are cheering this on and celebrating this, but you're not talking about those other things, you just might be racist. Let's put that out there.
Well, and we want to persuade people. We want mm-hmm. them to think about and consider different ways that they've been thinking about mm-hmm. this.
And that's
situation.
The nuance yeah. that's involved yeah. in it. Yeah. That's yeah. they want to say law and order. When I hear the law and order candidate, like I think of somebody, you know, I think of like over policing communities of color, mm-hmm. and
that's what they mean by that.
Yeah, and like that's what they're whispering. I mean,
Trump is
yeah.
saying on the law and order president. He's like, I'm a racist bastard, and I'm gonna, you know,
yeah, and like communities, yeah. we know what he's really saying yeah. when he says that.
Well, and he obviously doesn't follow it for himself.
No, so, of course not. No, it's not, it doesn't. It's not for him. It's, you know, it's not for him or for white people. It's to let people know I will, you know, over police, you know, people of color.
And I think part of it is, you know, high profile crimes with African-American actors, whether it's O.J. Simpson or Jesse Smollett or whatever, mm-hmm. it gets a disproportionate amount of attention because mm-hmm. of the fact that there is this fog of racism that mm-hmm. makes people want to see a black person be punished more severely, even if they are guilty for that crime.
I remember I was in fourth grade when the O.J. verdict was read, mm-hmm. and I went to a predominantly Catholic co-ed grammar school, and I remember when they said not guilty, people were cheering. When I got home, my mom was like, "What are we cheering for? What did we win?" Like, we didn't win anything. Well, O.J. Simpson prize.
A lot of kids were happy that he was not guilty.
I remember that. I remember cheering. I was like, why, like, are we cheering? Because it became this white versus black kind of issue.
Oh, yeah.
And my parents were just like, we didn't win anything. Mm-hmm. Like, my O.J. Simpson prize, nothing. Like,
yeah. Do you know there's been another theory about how Nicole Brown Simpson died?
Oh, what is that?
In the past, I think there was like a documentary that talked about this. It wasn't O.J. Simpson didn't do it, but he did help cover up the crime. It was his son who killed Nicole Brown Simpson, who had mental health issues.
Allegedly. And
so his son had been having violent outbursts, and he had been off of his medication, and he invited Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman to his restaurant that night to eat, and he made this fabulous meal for them that they blew it off. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the reason why the glove never fit him is because there was the glove that was for his son. I don't know if that is necessarily the truth, but it's interesting to see that there's this alternative theory that has come forward in the past decade.
People still talk about that.
Yeah. And part of it is, I think, you know, because we have an unresolved we have a very racist, very vocal. I think racism has become a bigger problem in the past 4 years than it was in the past, and this is certainly the Achilles heels of America.
Up to it for sure.
I think it's escalating. You know, it's not just a problem that we're becoming more conscious of. Is we're starting to see more incidences of violence towards minorities and marginalized people.
Well, I think
hate crimes are on the rise.
I think racist because of who's in office feel emboldened to be outwardly racist. Mm-hmm. I remember when he came into office and. you could read their website, there was no mention of LGBT people or people of color. And because of that, we have a president who's like literally grabbing women by their vaginas and, mm-hmm. And has accusations of rape accusations against him. And they, well, if the president can do it, so can I.
Let's move to something a little bit happier. Is the Oscars. Janelle Monáe opened year's Oscars, standing on stage, covered in flowers, saying, "I am proud to be here as a proud Black queer woman."
Yes.
Oscar hashtag Oscar 2020. Billy Porter, although I don't think Billy Porter is in any films. Every award ceremony needs a little something, something, as Billy Porter says. And adding a little Billy Porter to the mix always makes things special. However, people on the internet are saying, some people are saying, Billy Porter is trying too hard.
Too hard to be fabulous.
Just let him be great. Let him be great. I think he's leveraging the red carpet to express himself. Mm-hmm. And Billy, I remember when he was when they did Campy at the Met Gala, mm-hmm. and I feel like Billy Porter, from when he's been in the entertainment industry for years, I mean, he's been on Broadway, and I think again he's using the red carpet as a way to kind of have fun with his outfits and to, as an extension of his personality.
Steen Sealer, hello,
hello,
don't hate.
Let's do the checklist. Billy Porter, does he have a Grammy? Yes. Does he have a Tony? Yes. Kinky Boots. Does he have an Emmy? For Pose, yes. All he's missing is an Oscar.
Mm.
So he's not trying that hard. I mean, he is working. He's in the game. So I mean,
well, people like most of his outfits, but they really hated that dress and boots that he wore on the red carpet for some reason.
The thing, and let me just position this: if you have a problem with Billy Porter's, part of you is dying inside. And I'm a person who I look at Billy Porter and I look at him with huge admiration, joy and delight in my heart, and seething jealousy that I don't have access to those fierce, fabulous gowns myself.
It's a whole experience when you look at his outfit.
Oh, you know, to me, it was the little...
Oh, the little cowboy thing?
The hat that had the curtains that open and close.
Shade hat.
I love when we combine electronics and fashion together. I'm such a huge fan of fashion off the rails. We dedicate this podcast to this topic, you know? And to me, it's like, as Cher said, when you think you've gone too far, go bigger.
Yeah, that's what she's doing, too.
And that's what she dressed. Yeah. Remember when Cher wore that Bob Mackie black plumed
outfit? He wasn't
outfit?
Even born, huh?
But you've read about it. Yeah. And the outrage was that. And a part of me, I was
they can
like,
stay mad.
That's the whole point of the Oscars, is to showcase fashion off the rails, you know? Kristen Wiig, she looked like a lasagna server.
Yes! I saw that meme.
So she's wearing this dress, and I think intentionally she understands what we're thinking, which is like, this is a race to see how wild you can get.
Yeah, how weird.
How weird. And weird is good. Weird is wild and wonderful. Weird means that the marginalized people get heard. Weird means that we start to celebrate the weird in everyone. And weird is about not fitting in. It's about being, instead of in a world with circles and squares, you're the one who has ruffles.
I mean, why not?
Yeah.
Why the hell not?
I approve. But Billy Porter, return my calls. We've been trying to get you on this podcast for 15 years. The Love time Pose. Is long overdue.
Love Pose. And they're doing a really great job, Pose. I remember last season of kind of having those conversations around HIV and AIDS as well, of like having the characters talk about it and the fear of it. And
seeing what it was like at that point in time. And just
exactly.
Gosh, what they went through to... It breaks your heart.
I was there.
Well, I mean, I wasn't living in New York. You know what I mean?
I
wasn't in New York. And it was like, you know, there was certain epicenters during the AIDS crisis. I was, you know, thankfully I wasn't living in one. I did lose some people from AIDS. And even just, you know, recently even, it's still happening.
And that's part of the thing is like, I think Pose kind of makes those feelings that we had, it validates them, and it explains to people why we feel the way we do about living and surviving through the AIDS crisis. And it brings to light so many survivors' triumphs in how they overcame being marginalized in so many ways with humor, with fashion, with performance.
And the idea of chosen family.
Yeah, and it's just like, you know, too many drag performers, too many ball people, they're all just like, RuPaul's Drag Race, RuPaul's Drag Race. I'm going to get on television, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And back then, it was like, no one had a fucking hope that they would ever be on television. We were doing this because we loved putting on glitter on our faces and wearing a pair of high heel shoes and strutting the runway, sweetie. Mm-hmm. We didn't even have high hopes for RuPaul. And when Milton Berle and RuPaul got into a fight, then RuPaul disappeared for almost a decade, we were just like, that's what we're used to. So seeing RuPaul on Saturday Night Live last weekend, regardless of how you feel about RuPaul's, you know, limitations in how trans people are represented on RuPaul's Drag Race or lack of representation or lack of casting people, this was a landmark moment for LGBTQ visibility and for people of color.
Yeah, and it's definitely setting and it's opening the doors because you do have a lot of grassroots kind of media networks, like we mentioned OTV, Open Television, Slate TV, in New York are who are doing like kind of these black queer versions of Netflix and Amazon who've been doing it for years and are getting finally kind of getting more of that representation. And I think that I think it's a great thing. And so in some ways we're kind of in a resurgence of like the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah. All right. The Harlem Renaissance, can you explain to people what that was?
Because we have an international audience.
Okay, so the Harlem Renaissance took place back in the 1920s. And so like it was like you had prolific poets like Langston Hughes, James Baldwin was another cornerstone. And it was like kind of like you had these literary treasures that started in Harlem in New York, and it reached kind of mainstream attention. And it had a lot of influence on like kind of modern day literature, too, as well as jazz. And also you had Langston Hughes was gay. Mm-hmm. James Baldwin was gay, and they were like very much a part of the Harlem Renaissance. And so it's basically this period of how do I explain this? This period, I want to do it justice. This period of kind of literary greatness from these black poets and jazz musicians.
It was an explosion of black culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, Parasite becomes the first South Korean movie to win the Best International Film Oscar. Or I think it was Best Film.
Best Film and Best International Film.
And the director,
Boon Joon-ho, had his little gay moment afterwards. He took two of his Oscars and he had them kissing each other. And they're just like, aw, that's so sweet.
Well, he also was said, he threw out some shade out there and says, if you have a problem with my movie getting an Oscar, it probably might be because you, that one little inch in the bottom of the screen with the words you can't read.
He called people illiterate. Pretty much.
Well, and it's, and, you know, part of me is like, look, I paid money to go see a movie, not to read the bottom of the screen. If I do that, I'll just buy a book.
Maybe they could dub it for you.
You forget about the subtitles. I went to the theaters to see Parasite, and I think this is the power of art. Like no matter who it's coming from, if it resonates with you. I still think about that movie.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, it really does. You know, talk to you about class and culture, and you know what when I first saw advertisements for it, they made it more seem like it was a horror film, right?
They did.
So I was really expecting like tentacle porn or something, like because they're like Parasite, something's gonna come out, like chests were gonna explode and stuff. And it wasn't any of that. It was really like, now they're doing it more like, no, it's a dark comedy with a lot of great social commentary. And it really is, it just wraps you up into that story and just like, oh, this is amazing. Now there are some things in it that are very terrifying, but you know,
it's not
one of those things where you like have to close your eyes kind
it's
of
not
stuff.
Gory.
In the words of the great Cicely Strong for Saturday Night Live, go Parasites! Oh, you're a fan of the movie Parasite? No, I just got an infection, must have.
And of course, gay icon Elton John won big. He got an Oscar that night himself. And
for being a
beautiful new wig.
Fierce queen.
I love Elton.
They gave him a little Oscar statue with a dress and high heels and glasses.
Elton John and Brad Pitt had the best male wigs, I think.
Yeah, both of them have hair pieces.
Yeah, I don't think
really?
Brad Pitt has hair. I think pretty much anything you see him, that's what I heard, is everything's a hair piece.
Well, people say that about me, and I'm like, girl, it's...
Well, sometimes you are wearing a wig.
That's true.
It was a lot of silver daddies there too.
Mm. Oh yes, honey.
Like, lay on top of me.
Buffet.
Oscar
and well paid.
You know they got good jobs too.
Yeah.
They got the Oscars.
Have you ever been to one of those Hollywood mansions with a swimming pool like that you see in the movies?
I unfortunately
people
have
do cocaine
not.
And drown in the pool.
Well, I have not.
Not yet.
Not yet at least.
I've always dreamed of being in a Hollywood mansion. You know,
I think we can make that happen. Let's like,
really?
we should like make that happen or something.
I just want to be it's invited.
I'm sure you guys know somebody like in Hollywood.
I do, but they never invite me to stuff, you know? Yeah,
when I ring the doorbell, they're just like, nobody's home.
I'll bring a bottle of something.
Yeah, let's do it, honey. Eminem performed the Oscars and everybody was like, what? Who?
Why is he here? Why is this homophobe here? I don't know what it is about like Eminem and people get mad about his homophobia. It's like one of those. Part of me is like, I just don't care.
The thing about it, I really don't think Eminem is homophobic. Maybe I'm a bad guy.
He uses the F word and stuff like
when
that.
When he
in his
first
music.
Started mm-hmm. collaborating with Elton John, it was controversial. Yes.
I remember that.
And Elton John had to defend him publicly. Mm-hmm. And people thought that Elton John was a sellout for his collaboration with Eminem. Mm. And, you know, Eminem, he ain't hard. He's now a daddy.
He is a daddy. He's grown up a lot.
I love that I'm finally a sex symbol. Yay!
Daddies are in.
But he's been a dad for a long time now. I mean, his kid's probably in college, right?
How old is Eminem? He has to be in his 40s. Like
he's mid-40s. Definitely in his 40s, for sure.
What do you guys make of Jane Fonda's plastic surgery showcase? She stood up on the stage and was like, she looks fabulous.
I think she looks great. And she actually, she's doing what she preaches. Like she wore a dress that she wore a few years ago.
I mean, there's a MILF mother. I'd like that. She's a GILF.
She looks good.
Grandma, I'd like to fuck. You know what I'm saying? It's like she is getting all the Silver Panthers all excited.
I don't know if I can keep up with her.
You what?
I don't know if I could keep up with her.
Oh, really?
Like she looks like she works out. She looks good.
She does work out.
Well, yeah, she looks amazing.
She used to have these, you know, workout videos back in the day. And that's the thing. When you move, it keeps you young.
You know that exercise that Jane Fonda is famous for doing where you're lifting your leg
on the side legs?
Oh, legs is actually really good for your back and for your stomach.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've started doing it. And you're like, you think you're in shape and you try doing those and you're like, oh my God, this is so hard to do. It's like, just do like a minute of leg lifts on each side three times and you're going to be exhausted by the time you're done doing it.
Try that when I get home.
The Visual Effects Association would like you to know that it's not funny to laugh at the movie Cats.
What?
Oh, God.
And they issued a statement saying they are mad at the Oscars and mad the two actors from Cats, who's
Rebel Wilson and James Condren.
Condren, yes, who for that stunt they pulled at the Oscars where they showed up in actual cat furry suits.
I thought it was pretty funny.
And I thought they looked better than what they did in the film. Mm. If the film had actually had people wearing fur suits and said, you know, if you can't handle wearing the fur, get out of here, you know? It's like, and that's part of the reason a lot of the actors did the movie Cats is because it was all CGI for.
I didn't see that movie, but I remember seeing the trailer and just laughing at the trailer. Like, is that Idris Elba? That is Idris Elba.
I'll watch it when it comes on Netflix. You know what I mean? Same. But I'm like, I could pay money to go see this and just laugh at it. But to be honest with you, Terrence, I want to tell you my true fear is that I would go to this movie with my husband and I, you know, it would be terrible, but my husband would love it. And that's really what I was afraid of.
Would you love it, Austin?
Well, I'm a huge fan of bad Broadway. Mm-hmm. I love the Tina Turner and leg warmers look that the 80s Cats, the Andrew Lloyd Webber Broadway sensation was. And when that movie came, when that play reached the zeitgeist, like I remember Gloria Estefan did a music video, Boys Will Be Boys, Bad Boys.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
And she has people from the musical Cats in it for no reason. And at the very end of the movie, she gets transformed into one of the cats. memory.
It's gay.
It's totally gay.
It's so gay. It speaks to us.
You know, and it speaks to me like this whole gay Broadway actor, singer, dancer aesthetic. And a lot of people of color who couldn't get cast in roles in Broadway got cast in Cats because they were sort of able to hide their race, you know. And it, in a lot of ways, it opened up a lot of job opportunities for Latino and people of color on Broadway when that show was in its height, you know, before Julie Taymor made being black popular again, you know.
Well, being black has always been popular.
Well, not on Broadway, you know. There was a lot of limitations on that, you know, and The Lion King showed that that plays and musicals that, you know, where it was a all black cast, it was a where the African-American experience and the black actors were front and center, could not only be successful, it could not only be critically acclaimed, but also a financial hit.
Yeah. And we saw that with Black Panther and like, I mean,
Hamilton, the musical, Hamilton,
like amongst us, we knew that, like, you know, if given the opportunity, it can reach mainstream success. Mm-hmm. And so, and not that you, I think it's to like what, Joaquin Phoenix was saying, like, no one's looking for a handout. It's just one opportunity.
Well, and part of it is, you know, your bigotry, your racism is if you, it's costing you. And I think about, like, you know, why Disney in terms of as an entertainment company has won so much in its history is because as a corporation and as a content creation company, it's embraced racial diversity to the point of almost not making any sense at all with the Cinderella. Remember Cinderella with Brandy?
Yeah. We hated that movie so much as kids. It's like, okay, we appreciate the effort, mm-hmm. but this is silly.
But like, you remember, it was like,
well,
it was,
it's like, why is it silly? Why do we have that in our mind that just like, this is a family? Like, why can't a family look like this? Why can't a people look like this?
Well, because everybody was going, why Whoopi Goldberg and that white actor does not equal Asian child.
it just doesn't even make any sense. But I think what they were trying to do, like, it was almost
but
like,
why does it need to?
It just didn't, at the time, feel very seamless.
Yeah.
Like, oh, like, it was like contrived, mm-hmm. like contrived, like kind of like a Sunny D commercial. Mm-hmm. Like, remember those commercials where they have the Asian kid, the black kid, the white kid, and like, and they're just sitting around chilling.
The United Colors of Benetton. Another,
well,
big,
you know, like Whitney Houston said, impossible for a for a plain country bumpkin and a prince to join in marriage.
Aww.
Even impossible. Another has big, possible in it.
Winner yeah. on the night of the Oscars was Renee Zellweger, who won for playing Judy Garland in Judy.
She was great in that movie.
She was great in that movie. And I looked back on finally on interviewing Peter Mack, who is probably one of the foremost Judy Garland impersonators. We've had him on the podcast a couple of times. And then we had him come on to talk about that movie specifically. And he really liked Renee his performance as Judy Garland, but he had a real problem with the storyline because that's not really Judy's storyline. That's not really her life the way it should have been portrayed. Mm-hmm. And so after the Oscars that night, I go to his page to see how his reaction was. No mention of Judy Garland.
Shade.
No mention of that. But he does do a rounding shout out to Judy Davis for her wonderful performance as Judy Garland in the miniseries that was done in the early 2000s.
Who has this wonderful quote. You think it's easy being Judy Garland? I've been trying to be Judy Garland all my life.
And so I just commented that on it. It was just like, oh my God, the shade of it all. And he's just like, I was just trying to be honest. I'm like, yeah, but you know, it's still shady.
I mean, like, it's like out of omission.
It's kind of out of omission. And I think that that's kind of the thing. It's the best kind of shade because it's like, it's the things that aren't said, the things that are left in the dark, the implied critique.
It kind of reminds me a little bit when the Economist podcast, they were interviewing Anna Wintour, and they kept on asking her about Melania Trump, and she just would go back to Michelle Obama.
Oh yeah,
and say,
yeah.
She's wonderful. I think she's the greatest first lady. And she would keep asking about Melania, but she would steer the conversation to Michelle Obama and how great she was.
Oh yeah, that was hilarious. Wonderful. That was absolutely wonderful.
She's a freaking pro.
Anna Wintour is the queen of shade, honey. Mm-hmm. And don't you fuck with her. Mm-hmm. Don't you mess with her.
She's not here for anybody's games.
That's all. Terrence Chappelle, it's so good talking to you.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Have you done the broomstick challenge yet?
I haven't, but you showed me when Paula Abdul was dancing around her broomstick. I thought that was kind of cool.
Two step forward, two steps
back. I'm going to try it when I go home.
Yeah, it kind of makes your home look like Beauty and the Beast.
Where all the things come to life. I love that.
If only the mop and broom actually came to life on their own.
And just do the work. That'd be a little scary.
Be like, no, it's like a Roomba. You know, be like, be our guest.
I can get with it.
Hey, salt, pepper, come on, I'm hungry.
Do your job. Get it together, come on.
And they're like, revolt. Can you imagine? Because, you know, in the Beauty and the Beast movie, the furniture attacked the villagers that came in to kill the beast. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm sure. And I'm like thinking, it was like, wait a second. This is a monarchy. Why don't you just revolt against the beast?
The candle is my favorite character.
Lumiere.
Yes, that's him. I love that.
That was played by Jerry Orbach, who just passed away this past year.
In the cartoon, yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
No.
It was based on a Maurice Chevalier character.
Yeah, I believe in the
In memoriam.
No, I'm confusing him with the other actor that looks like him. Not Jerry Orbach is the one who did the voice, but it was somebody else who just passed away this year in memoriam. Because Jerry Orbach died in 2004. Sorry. Nobody puts baby in the corner. Sorry, Jerry.
But he was Lumiere in the
original. Yes. Yeah. Jerry Orbach, who played the Lenny in Law and Order.
And the dad in
Dirty Dancing. Mm-hmm. He also did the
voice of Lumiere. Oh, yeah, Abraham.
Be a guest. Be a guest.
Well, it's always a pleasure being you guys' guest.
Oh,
thanks.
Don't wait so long to come back.
I won't. I definitely won't.
Try the gray stuff. It's delicious. Don't believe me? Ask Mark. He eats everything.
I'll eat it all. I would remind folks, we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feasttofun.com/plus because your contribution to the show is what makes this show happen.
In addition to accessing our archives, thousands and thousands of legendary shows on Feast of Fun Plus, you get an ad-free feed. You don't hear any ads as a member of Feast of Fun Plus. So if these ads are bugging you, you're like, yeah, I ain't gonna want to sit through. This is an interrupting me. You can actually get an ad-free experience by going to feastofun.com/plus, and you'll have the comfort and joy and pleasure. I don't hear nobody talking about no pleasure up in here.
I've been talking about pleasure all day.
I'm all for pleasure.
Is in listening to your favorite podcast as long as you like and as often as you like. And we are launching 4 new podcasts this year. Because, you know, it's all about pleasure, baby.
These are busy.
4 new shows. What are they? They're coming soon. So subscribe to us on social media and be the first ones to find out about it. 4 new shows. Hint, hint. It's going to be delicious.
Terrence. Thank you, Terrence.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.